Today, we're expecting to hear what the Federal Reserve thinks about the economy. Fed policymakers finish a two-day meeting and say what they plan to do about interest rates, currently near zero. Few people expect a change right now, though some policymakers may at least be thinking about it. NPR's John Itzty reports.
While policy may remain unchanged, there will likely be a spirited discussion over whether or not the Fed should change course. And we could get some detail about the give and take around the table because Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke will hold a news conference after the meeting. These news conferences happen four times a year and coincide with updates of the Fed's economic forecast. Like most observers, Randall Krosner, a former Fed governor, now a professor at the University of Chicago, believes that Fed policymakers will stand pat on interest rates.
At this point, I think the Fed is going to stick with that long-term commitment to keep interest rates low. There really hasn't been enough information that's come in since the last meeting to suggest any change.
The most important piece of data was a disappointing employment report at the beginning of April, showing only 120,000 jobs added to the U.S. economy in March, half the number added in January and February. Krosner says that report vindicated Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's cautions about the economy when others were declaring victory earlier this year.
I think his caution is well warranted. We didn't want to start popping the champagne corks after just a few months of good data in the job market, because that's what a number of people did back in 2010. We're very disappointed. Did it again in 2011. We're very disappointed.
Since the jobs report, the economy has offered mixed messages. Stronger than expected retail sales, but flagging consumer confidence. There were some signs again yesterday that the housing market may have bottomed out, but John Tusillo, a former economist with the National Association of Realtors and now chief economist at Florida Real Estate, says it all depends on jobs.
If we don't see strong job growth, then we're not going to have a real estate market that will come back sooner rather than later. So, yeah, so it's extremely important.
And Randall Krosner says it's still unclear where the job market and the economy are headed.
I don't see recession on the horizon, but I don't see breakout growth coming either. And I think given the mixed data that's out there, reasonable people can disagree.
So Krosner says there'll be a rich discussion around the Open Market Committee table, but no change in policy. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
In our series Family Matters, Morning Edition is exploring the pressures facing baby boomers who live in multi-generational families. Yesterday, we heard from Natasha Shimon Gilmore. She's 58 years old, lives in Maryland with her husband, son, and her father, who's 81 years old. She spoke to NPR's David Green.
So in the morning, my head's spinning because I'm thinking of all things that have to be done.
What kind of paperwork? What is
I still need to get will for my dad. I still need to get power attorney.
Does anyone help you with this? Like, is there one person who can help you through this?
I'm not going to help, really.
For any grown child or family who takes in an aging and ailing parent, it can be emotionally overwhelming and financially draining. Jane Gross of the New York Times went through this herself. She cared for her mother in the years leading up to her death at the age of 88 and has written about that experience in her book, A Bittersweet Season. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Renee.
Give us a thumbnail of your experience. What was the moment you decided to take over your mother's care?
She had been living in Florida for a long time. Her health rather suddenly started to decline. My brother and I both lived in the New York area, which was the family home, and we all decided that this would be a much more manageable event if we were all in the same place. And I think we also understood that, you know, there was probably a limited time left and it would be nice to spend it closer to each other.
And when you thought of limited time, were you thinking in terms of a few years of care?
I tell you the truth, I wasn't even really thinking that clearly. I was panicked more than I was thinking clearly. I just knew we had to do something, and whatever it was, it would be easier if I didn't have to jump on an airplane every time.
Your mother passed away nearly a decade ago in 2003, and she was in your direct care there in New York for several years, 4 years before that. Looking back, what do you know now that you wish you had known then?
Well, I was under the impression that Medicare was universal health care for people over the age of 65. I had no idea that the kind of long-term care as opposed to acute care that my mother and the vast majority of very old people need isn't covered by Medicare.
That, I think, will be a surprise to most people, because the sense is that once you get to the age where you're covered by Medicare, pretty much all your care is covered.
If my mother had needed a heart transplant or a hip replacement, Medicare would cover that. Medicare does not cover what's known as custodial care, which means home health aides. It means assisted living. It means basically all of the stuff that makes it possible to be old and be looked after, you know, short of being cut open and fixed in some way.
How much of that sort of care then did your mother need? And what then happened? Who paid for it?
Mostly my mother paid for all of it. By my very rough estimate, in the last 9 years of my mother's life, she spent more than $500,000 out of pocket. At 6 months before she died, she technically ran out of money, which then entitles you to Medicaid. So once my mother was essentially deemed destitute, the government paid for it.
What about long-term care insurance? We always hear about that. A lot of people avoid it or postpone getting it. But you do think that it has a place in assuring a person or a family that they will be taken care of should, you know, one end up in a nursing home or need other long-term care.
Truth is somewhere in between. I think that people regard it as a panacea when it isn't. And my mother's long-term care policy, which had $150 a day benefit, goes to the nursing home, although rarely, if ever, is it enough to cover the nursing home.
You know, just before we started this conversation, we heard Natasha Gilmore saying she had no one to turn to for advice. Who did you have counseling you through this?
In the early stages, nobody. I eventually hired a geriatric care manager who unraveled virtually all of it. And it was still like that lady was talking about. The lawyers don't know anything about the money. The money people don't know anything about entitlements. The entitlement people don't know anything about residential choices. You spend most of your life on the telephone.
Is there an example of a single bad decision you made that you think, boy, that was a bad decision?
Yeah. I neglected, I'm embarrassed to say, to find my mother a primary care physician in New York before moving her. I discovered it's almost impossible to find a new one for somebody who is past Medicare age, because Medicare pays doctors so badly that they don't generally fire their existing patients, but they will very rarely take a new Medicare patient.
Given everything that you've just said, what about what one might even call the bright side of an extended decline?
I mean, I think that there's a huge bright side. In my case, I had a very difficult relationship with my mother, which, because of how long this lasted and because of how hard both of us worked at the relational part of it, we had a completely different relationship by the time she died. And it's those memories and sort of that mother that I take away with me. Also, my brother and I had a difficult relationship, and I'm not going to pretend it was easy while it was going on, because it wasn't, but my brother is now my best friend. I don't think that would have happened otherwise.
Thank you very much for sharing this with us.
Well, you're very welcome. I wish everybody who's going through it right now courage and an easier time.
Yes, well, thank you. Jane Gross is the author of A Bittersweet Season and founder of the New York Times blog, The New Old Age.
The economic news from Britain is not good. According to the UK's Office for National Statistics, that country is now in recession. And having just been in recession in 2008 and 2009, this counts as a double dip. As we just heard, David Cameron appeared today at Prime Minister's Question Time in the House of Commons, and on the subject of recession, the Prime Minister faced the wrath of the opposition Labour Party leader, Ed Miliband.
Why doesn't he admit it? It's his catastrophic economic policy, his plan for austerity, cutting too far and too fast, that has landed us back in recession.
There is not a single business organisation or serious commentator or international body that thinks these problems emerged in the last 24 months. The debt crisis has been long in making.
Prime Minister David Cameron defending himself there. Well, now to one serious commentator, Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, who joins us from New York. Welcome back to the program.
Pleasure.
And we should say you have been no fan of David Cameron's economic policies. But is this double-dip recession, can you blame it on his policies?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important to stress that I don't really care about double dips. The really important point is that since the third quarter of 2010, the economy has been stagnant. Hmm. Essentially, it has ceased to grow. That's much more worrying than what has happened in two quarters. Yes, and I think he is to blame for that. Of course, we got into the crisis for deep reasons, as he's stressed many times, but the stagnation that has occurred after a reasonable recovery from a very deep recession has been due to the fiscal policy we've been following, along with some rather bad external shocks.
The fiscal policy has been one of austerity, cut government spending, reduce government pay, reduce some services, try to get Britain's debt reduced and under control. Some would say, well, that's always been a long-term policy. There's going to be pain in the short term because the payoff will be in the distance somewhere. Is there anything to that argument?
I should add, by the way, quite a bit of it was raising taxes. And one of the problems is that they've raised our value-added tax, which is a national sales tax, and that was inflationary and reduced real income, so it hit consumption. I think the point about this is quite simple. We obviously have to get our fiscal position back under control. It's almost impossible to do that while the private sector is deleveraging, because if you try, the economy gets very, very weak, and as a result, the fiscal deficit doesn't close as fast as you hope. And that is exactly what has been happening.
We've heard a bit of a fairly vigorous, if theatrical, debate from the House of Commons. Is there a real vigorous discussion in Britain right now of what the government's fiscal policies should be? Or David Cameron says he's disappointed, but he's standing by his austerity plan.
Well, first of all, I think the coalition government is really stuck. They went out of their way to commit themselves to a certain fiscal path. They are clearly sticking with it. The one good piece of news is, though, the outcome has been far worse than they had hoped for. They're not tightening even more, so they haven't been actually insane. By and large, most of business and many commentators have supported the government, and people who've taken my view are still a minority. But I feel less an outlier now than I did a couple of years ago when I made the argument that this was going to lead to disappointment.
Just one other question. If we were on, we would say here on Main Street, on the High Street somewhere in the UK, how would we be feeling the austerity program? What's the impact on everyday life?
Well, obviously, unemployment is quite high now, more or less at U.S. levels. Young people are finding it very, very difficult to find a job. And then, of course, lots of people who work for the public sector or depend on public benefits can expect their jobs in the former case and their real incomes in the latter case to be squeezed now year after year after year. It's not over. And that's why I think every year when the economy starts to feel as though it might recover, this is going to knock the ground from underneath it. And so it just gets worse.
Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. A load of information today from the Federal Reserve's Policymaking Committee, but no action. After a two-day meeting where officials discussed the economy and interest rates, policymakers decided to stand pat They said, as they've said before, that a stronger economic recovery requires keeping interest rates exceptionally low through 2014. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke defended that policy in a news conference after the meeting. NPR's John Itzty reports.
4 times each year, Fed policymakers update their forecast for the economy, and the Fed chairman holds a press conference to further explain things. This time around, the forecast showed a slightly faster growth rate for the economy in 2012, a little more than 2.5%, slightly higher inflation, close to 2%, and a slightly lower unemployment rate, 8% or just below. It also indicated that the Fed intends to hold interest rates exceptionally low, near zero, until late 2014. The statement the committee issued was almost exactly the same as the one issued in March. Chairman Bernanke said despite the slight changes to the forecast, no change in interest rate policy was needed.
That doesn't mean we might not take further action. We are certainly prepared to take further action. But for the time being, it appears that we are more or less in the right place.
Chairman Bernanke made it clear that the Fed had not ruled out added stimulus to the economy, including another round of quantitative easing, buying up more government bonds to try to push interest rates lower. But he said there was no reason to do that now. Still, Bernanke said the unemployment rate remains too high.
The most frustrating aspect, I guess, of the recovery has been that it's been quite slow. And as a result, here we are almost 3 years from the beginning of the expansion, and the unemployment rate is still over 8%.
If that's the case, the chairman was asked, why not do another round of stimulus to push the unemployment rate down, even if it risks a bit more inflation? The Fed chairman had this response.
Does it make sense to actively seek a higher inflation rate in order to achieve a slightly increased pace of reduction in the unemployment rate? The view of the committee is that that would be very reckless.
Bernanke said that's because the added reduction in the unemployment rate would be very small and not worth the risk of setting off another round of inflation. As for dangers to the economy, the committee again pointed to the strains in global financial markets. In his news conference, Bernanke made clear they were talking about Europe's debt problems. But the other looming problem is the scheduled expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the payroll tax break later this year. Unless Congress takes action, the increase in taxes could crush consumer spending and the economic recovery. A scary thought, said Bernanke.
If no action were to be taken by the fiscal authorities, the size of the fiscal cliff is such that there is, I think, absolutely no chance that the Federal Reserve could or would have any ability whatsoever to offset that effect on the economy.
A dire warning to the Congress and whoever occupies the White House after the election to find agreement on fixing the nation's finances. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.